Hello, SFIA audio listeners. In this month's Nebula exclusive, Giant Space Monsters, we'll take a look at what sorts of alien behemoths might be possible under known science. To hear it and every episode early and ad-free, plus hours of bonus content, check out go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur and use my code IsaacArthur. At some point, we're going to run out of living room. So how can we use celestial circular innovation to put humanity's lack of real estate in the rearview mirror? Today we'll be looking at the Banks Orbital, an immense megastructure in the form of a ring-shaped habitat more than a million miles in diameter, and depending on the ring's width, containing hundreds, if not thousands, of Earth's worth of living area, all enjoying more naturally Earth-like conditions than any other rotating habitat design. We were talking about assembling a structure that makes all of humanity's combined constructions to date look like a toddler's sandcastle. We'll be deep diving this structure, its engineering, why it's desirable, and what life on it might be like. So let's jump into the cosmic deep end and find out just what it takes to live in space's answer to luxury living, spiced with a touch of celestial extravagance. Rotating habitat megastructures have a lot going for them. They let you pick your gravity and pressure and use way less material than a planet does for creating a given amount of living space. And since they are spin gravity environments, not mass generated, it's very easy for spaceships to come to and from. Unfortunately, the problem we have with our three classic rotating habitats, the Brownian Sphere, O'Neill Cylinder, and Stanford Torus, is that they are generally in the size range of a large town or county, not a planet. And for the Brownian Sphere and O'Neill Cylinder, when you look up to the sky, you see the other side of that interior, more landscape. Imagine living in a place where the sky isn't filled with stars, but more real estate. It's the ultimate in not being able to escape the neighbors. The Stanford Torus is a lot skinnier, so you see a big ring in that sky, but also a big glass dome above. They often have to use either big mirrors or glass panes to let in natural sunlight, or create it artificially. These are hardly fatal flaws, especially compared to conditions on most other planets even when heavily terraformed, but they are not ideal either. Larry Niven's Ring World seeks to get around this by building an enormous ring around a star as wide as Earth's orbit, but besides requiring materials stronger than anything we could plausibly imagine, you still have to put big sunshades orbiting between the ring and your star to block light to give day and night. And while it contains a million planets with a living area, it is a pretty big lift to build. Ian M. Banks' orbitals, from his cultural series, also sometimes called God's Bracelet for their shape and magnitude, seek to split the difference in size while also allowing very natural lighting. And we have tricks that would let us build them out of known materials without requiring super strong tensile materials, though at the cost of a lot more mass. Graphene, our go-to for continent-class habitats, has such a strong tensile strength that it lets us build habitats like the Bishop Ring or McKendree Cylinder that are orders of magnitude larger than the O'Neill Cylinder or Stanford Torus, but still are smaller than a planet. So better, but still not there. The Bishop Ring lets in natural sunlight, but also needs hugely tall rim walls to keep the air in compared to its size, since the altitude of your atmosphere is the same on them as on ring boards millions of times bigger in area. They also spin around a lot faster than once a day to keep gravity at Earth normal of 1G, so you can't really use the natural sunlight and have to go for a rotating hub mirror, or fake sun. The Banks Orbital, however, can rotate once a day. For any given planet and day length, there is a unique diameter for a rotating habitat that allows you to mimic its gravity while rotating its own day length. For Earth gravity and a 24-hour day, that is a radius of 1.84 million kilometers, or 1.15 million miles. Size really does matter when it comes to playing Earth. That's a big number, so let me put that in perspective. That's over 2.5 times the radius of the Sun, which is the largest body in the solar system by far. So while a Banks orbital still needs a rim wall, even a rim wall 1,000 miles high that leaks less air than Earth itself does would be minuscule in comparison to the ring's size. For Martian gravity, which has about the same day length as Earth, that radius drops to about the radius of the Sun. It would be even lower for the Moon, but because its day is a month long, that radius jumps up to 267 million kilometers, or something bigger than the orbit of Mars around the Sun. The longer the day, the wider your ring needs to be, the higher the gravity, the faster it needs to spin. And the wider and faster both add to the strength requirements a ring needs to avoid being ripped apart by its own spin and angular momentum. Tensile strength is the bedrock of rotating habitats, literally, and nothing we know of has the material strength for an Earth-like Banks orbital. We're in the realm of needing something so strong it makes graphene look like overcooked spaghetti, and that's saying something. However, as we discussed in our episode on ring molds and continent-class habitats, we can cheat around this by building a second and more massive outer ring that our inner ring can spin inside and, like a maglev train, move over it very quickly by pushing off it without touching. That outer ring needs to be strong as well, and the more massive you make it, the less strong it needs to be. One of the neat things about rotating habitats is you can get some free launch speed or slow down by landing on the spinning hull, which is a lot trickier if you have a non-rotating outer sheath like this. As channel regulars know, I am of the opinion that rotating habitats will usually be a drum nest inside a larger superstructure that either doesn't rotate or counter-rotates with the same angular momentum but more mass and less speed. So for me, this outer ring is already a normal feature of any rotating habitat. Incidentally, unless stated otherwise, for the rest of the video when I say a Banks orbital, I mean one that emulates Earth's day length and gravity. It is our default condition, though of course if you're hunting for alien megastructures, you would want to widen that range, as their planet probably doesn't match our gravity and day length. So too, since it's easier to build a lower gravity habitat or one with a shorter day, we shouldn't rule out people building them with lower gravity, though while I could see folks going for a longer day, I can't see them opting for a shorter one very often. As a reminder, our Banks orbital is 1.85 million kilometers or 1.15 million miles in radius. If you resurrected the fastest commercial plane ever, the Concorde, with its 1350 mile per hour, greater than twice the speed of sound cruising speed, and circumnavigated the ring with in-air refueling and no stops, it would take you over 7 months to get back where you started. In short, don't expect to get anywhere fast without current modes of transportation. For every 43.8 kilometers or 27.2 miles that orbital is wide, you gain an Earth's worth of surface area. So in contrast to the Concorde example, for an orbital with the same surface area as Earth, you could just about fit the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, Switzerland, that discovered the Higgs boson particle into that 27 miles of width. Or for you fitness bunnies, if we had a Banks orbital with the same surface area as Earth, you could just squeeze in a marathon race across its width. Needless to say, I think you would build them a lot wider. This structure would orbit about as far away as Earth does from our Sun, depending on the brightness of its star and how warm you want your orbital. None of that needs to be tundra or desert, as it is a flat ring, not a curved planet with an axial tilt. You can actually tilt the rings to give them seasonal variation, but the whole of the ring will be in the same season at a time, which would play havoc with seasonally migrating species rehoused for an Earth-like world with seasons. It also doesn't technically have seasonal variation in day length, but the rim walls cast longer shadows in the winter, making it less bright. This will confuse the daylights out of plant and wildlife that rely on seasonal day-night length variation. Incidentally, there will be two summer-winter cycles per rotation around the star, adding further consternation. Though if you are as good at genetic engineering as you are mega engineering, this is probably easily fixed. The orbital lies mostly flat on its orbital plane, also called the ecliptic. The portion of the orbital currently close to the star, if it is wide enough in its night phase, will block light to the other side, usually getting daytime. This plunges the whole orbital's inner surface into eternal night. The opposite extreme also causes complete night. This happens when the orbital is oriented perpendicular to the ecliptic and its axis is facing the star. In this case, the rim walls temporarily block light from reaching the inner surface. Conservation of momentum in conjunction with the rim walls gives the orbitals its seasons. Unlike our moon, which is tidally locked to always present the same face to Earth, the orbital won't be tidally locked to the star and actually faces the same direction, irrespective of its motion around the star. We have an analog of this behavior in our very own solar system. The planets rotate about their axis roughly perpendicular to the ecliptic plane, though like most families, there is one individual that doesn't follow the norm. And with planets, Uranus is our black sheep. It's actually cocked to have its axis lie almost on the ecliptic plane and isn't tidally locked to the Sun. If we track the orbit of Uranus and imagine a ring spinning there instead of a planet, You can imagine how the seasons would play out by how the star's light hits the ring's inner surface and how the rim walls would block some of that light, casting shadow when the ring's axis gets closer to pointing directly at the star. If you were standing on the inner surface of the orbital, the star would rise on one side of the orbital half the year and rise on the opposite side for the other half of the year. Much like any extreme northern or southern latitudes on Earth during the coldest months, the star at midday wouldn't be directly overhead and would hug the rim walls. The walls casting longer shadows over the inner surface landscape and not permitting them to heat up as much compared to when the star reaches zenith in the summer. How much the ring is tilted controls how severe this is. So while the orbital uses natural sunlight, has the same day-night cycle, gravity, atmosphere, and can be given seasons, it shouldn't be thought of as perfectly matching the conditions on Earth. We can fix the doubling up of seasons per year if we use a different star system, and I'll get to that in a bit, but the lack of a consistent direction for sunrise and sunset, the constant daytime irrespective of the season, and the lack of tides isn't going to play nice with animals and plants that rely on those things. Setting up working ecosystems will be a challenge without genetic engineering or careful selection of species. Things also get wildly different from Earth when we think about orbital velocities. The orbital rotates every 24 hours, and does so at a tangential speed of 301,000 miles per hour, or 0.045% of light speed, a very respectable interplanetary velocity. This would be sufficient for interstellar travel, albeit it would take just under 10,000 years to get to Alpha Centauri this way, so it provides a nice boost to or down from interplanetary velocities, and also ironically means that if you're patient and mining other solar systems for materials, you could sling them by mass drive to the system you want to broaden an existing orbital in and not need to slow them down, just tweaking the final trajectory and speed so it meets the orbital's inner surface at exactly the same relative speed. We'll get to how much material we need to build one in a bit, but let's talk about width. As mentioned, this thing is a couple of million miles wide in diameter, and every 27 miles of width in that band adds another Earth's worth of surface area. So you can get two eclipses a year, but only if the orbital is wide enough. Imagine having your day interrupted by a scheduled mini-eclipse, courtesy of your local orbital configuration. It's the new daylight saving time. You need an orbital in the order of 800 Earth's worth of surface area to actually get a full eclipse. That's a band 35,000 kilometers or 22,000 miles wide for the specific case of our sun and our orbital distance. So one this wide does have to be tilted to get sunlight too, and you might use minimal tilting and wide bands to moderate light if you really wanted a 365-day year, but that would be a bit closer to the local star than comfortable in terms of lighting. There's a lot of options. Incidentally, I'm borrowing heavily from the Encyclopedia Galactica entry on Banks Orbitals over at Orion's Arm, written principally by Stephen Innes. And since our calculations keep matching, I'm going to trust his going forward and save some time. One thing that gets mentioned in there that I don't recall noticing before is that when you tilt the ring, you create two warm seasons per year. For this reason, you could get away with a wide orbit too, to make a longer year if you want to avoid a double set of seasons per orbit. Another way to get seasons is to use an elliptical orbit, which will make it winter when the orbital is further away from the star and summer when it's closer to the star. You can also combine the two effects. If you thought deciding where to install and how to tilt your satellite dish was tricky, try choosing an orbit and tilting a megastructure for optimal seasonal variation. If the season variation is too quick for your preferences, a slightly brighter star than our G2 yellow sun might be preferable, such as a G1 or G0, or even an F8 or F9, as these are only a touch more massive than our sun, but a good deal brighter, so their habitable zone distance has a longer year, and again the lack of spherical curvature on these rings, like planets have, mean they are going to be warmer overall than planets at the same distance. You can also still use shades or mirrors to enhance or decrease or modify the brightness and spectrum of the native star, but while a Banks orbital is quite massive, it still isn't really going to have proper Lagrange points like a planet does, so your shade or lens or mirror needs to be a laggard to keep up good pacing with the ring's own orbit around that star. You could use a similar trick to give it a moon if you wanted, but that ring is still rather bright at nighttime, as we'll get to in a bit, along with mass. See our Statites and Laggards episode for more discussion of that. As a general point, the habitable zone and year length of any star is based on its brightness and mass, but brightness rises at a bit over the cube of mass, while orbital period drops with the inverse square root of mass, so habitable planets around red dwarfs have periods of weeks or months, while big giant stars can have habitable zone periods of centuries. That is for main sequence stars. I should also note that a subgiant star on its way to red giant is brighter for the same mass, and thus might also be popular places to stick such rings. The timeline for subgiant phases for stars like ours tends to be on an order of a billion years, so you can't easily migrate or increase your sun shields as it slowly brightens. Those L1 sun-altering effects are not altering that star to look unlike a normal sun, even ignoring that we do not look at the sun directly, which appears quite white if you do, not yellow. You would not really see a swarm of satellites that are altering the content of the light coming through. And of course, if you can build things, you can also migrate them. Should you decide your star is nearing its end, nothing stops you from artificially lighting one of these for a trip, and you could build your engine on the back side to serve as your fake sun for the trip, flipping it around for the slowdown. Should your star start showing its age, just pack up your several trillion square kilometers of living space and move. It's just like moving a house, but with a slightly bigger van. Of course, they take a lot of energy to move, and we should discuss mass. We usually hold that at a bare minimum, you need a meter of thickness under you, or at least 1 ton of material for every square meter of artificial land under your feet, and many would prefer something closer to a kilometer of landscape and hull under you at more than 1,000 times that mass. For Earth, that ratio is several thousand kilometers and about 12 million tons per square meter. That means your mass per unit of living area for routine habitats is normally anywhere from 10 million times as good as Earth to maybe 10,000 times. We tend to assume that bigger continent and planet-scale habitats go a lot thicker on their landscaping too, even if they are dimpling their hull for deeper or taller lakes or mountains and filling the latter with aerogel to cut down on mass. In the absence of something like mag matter that makes graphene seem like weak, warm butter, we have to use that thicker outer ring approach. That might be a giant torus, flattened on one side for the ring to sit inside, and the rest covered in solar panels and ancillary facilities. It might just be full of compressed hydrogen and helium gas too, like a donut-shaped brown dwarf, given their abundance and limited usefulness for construction. If you have a fusion economy that can actually use hydrogen or helium as your fuels, then it's a good way to store your reserves. And if not, if you can't do better than deuterium fusion, then it gives us something useful to do with that material. If we just for the moment imagine disassembling Jupiter to make such a ring from, and one of about 1,000 Earths worth of living area, you should have no problem getting all the material from Jupiter's core to build a mile-deep landscape, and still have tons left over for that outer ring. Disassembling Jupiter for material might just upset a few folks, but think of the real estate opportunities. Always look on the bright side of planetary destruction. Of course, for some of us, planetary destruction is the bright side too. Indeed, you should have enough material for several of these killer Earth-scale Banks orbitals, and you can always import from other star systems with less desirable locations or spectrums, if you need more material or want to leave Jupiter alone for sentimental reasons. A solar system like ours should have the raw materials for a couple hundred of them in this size range, or 1,000 the smaller variety of just 200 Earths worth that is referenced in Banks' novels discussing orbitals. And that's before resource extraction options like star lifting or importing matter from neighboring systems with less desirable stars. Field trips in a Banks orbital will be epic. Today's lesson, orbital mechanics, followed by a practical demonstration. Tomorrow, how not to get lost on a megastructure. Essential survival skills. You could in fact set these up like chain links, with each habitat on the same orbit of its sun, having a neighbor spinning through its middle with its seasonal angle cocked in the opposite direction. Usually when I refer to chain link worlds, I'm talking hoop worlds, donut-shaped artificial planets that are full of mass for gravity, but this is probably the easier version. Now I said temperature is the same everywhere, but that's not quite true and doesn't imply similar weather either. As an example, my home is at 42 degrees latitude and is in the northeast corner of Ohio, and is the same latitude as Rome in Italy. My area has only slightly more mild winters than Buffalo, New York, my home away from home, which is at 43 degrees and legendary for its snowy winters. Paris, France is way further north, 48 degrees, more than most of Canada's population, and London almost 52 degrees. Your landscape controls your weather and temperature a lot, and we can build those as we please on such artificial worlds. But not every place gets a 12-hour day all year either. Those rim walls are enormous structures hundreds of miles high, potentially even 1,000. We usually imagine stylizing them as impossibly tall mountains, and on smaller habitats, they would even have significantly lower gravity as you got higher. But on a Banks orbital, even a 1,000-mile-high wall is tiny compared to the radius under rotation, so gravity would barely diminish. In theory, they could be made of a clear material, but given the necessary thickness, I think even something translucent would be dubious. Indeed, you'd likely nest the ring and its entire rim wall in your outer torus for added protection, and that means you have shorter days near the rims. How much this affects the habitat as a whole depends on the width of your bracelet or axial length. Again, every 44 kilometers or 27 miles of this axial length is giving you another Earth of living area. But half your time, your area near a rim wall is under partial shadow, and how much just depends on the rim wall height and your tilt. If your habitat is much wider than your rim walls are tall, the effect is fairly minimal outside those areas, and the same if your axial tilt of the ecliptic is fairly minimal. The sharper the tilt, the more seasonal habitation habitat-wide, and the more shadow by that rim wall, and this will also help drive weather, especially as you might decide you don't want a flat ring, but one with a little curvature, either bowing up in the middle or down in the middle. Up in the middle means water will tend to drain toward the rim walls, down toward the middle, and you could get away with shorter rim walls if you had enough drop toward the center. Any mountain ranges you place throughout the habitat are going to locally cool things too, and these can help drive weather and break up storms, but there is no Coriolis effect and major temperature gradients driving the more vicious cyclonic weather we see on Earth, let alone places like Jupiter, which is much more massive than one of these rings but considerably smaller, though the axial tilt can allow some monsoon-like effects. You can also place them on a more elliptical orbit rather than something circular, so you can get your twice-a-year season from the tilt overlapping with your high eccentricity season caused by getting further and closer from the sun, with a summer effect when it's closest or at perihelion. In this way, you get a high summer effect by timing one of the two axial summers with the perihelion summer, and your aphelion winter would be the same time as your other summer, making it a lot more mild, or even still wintry if you're using a rather eccentric elliptical orbit. In the absence of a moon of real mass, which would probably be a pain in the neck, you do not get lunar tides. We're missing out on those romantic moonlight nights and werewolf stories, but on the bright side, no high tide means no unexpected swimming sessions. If you want a moon, you could fake one with Lygites or orbit some hollow moon around the Banks orbital, though I would not trust that moon option unless you were using the supermassive outer sheath secondary ring to add a lot of mass. You do still get solar tides though, and pretty impressive ones, as you are getting 2 million miles or 3 million kilometers closer and further from your sun every day as that bracelet spins. That's a 2% change in distance for an even spot of that ring relative to its sun every day, or a 4% change in its gravity on you, and that would parallel ocean tides here on Earth, though you might want to use smaller basins akin to seas or Great Lakes, which would reduce that. Those near dimmer stars will have worse tides, and those on eccentric orbits will have tides varying over the year as they get closer and further from the sun. Now, the one thing you probably don't have on these is a moon, and that's because they are wider than all moons' orbits, and unlike a sphere, a big ring is not exactly ideal for orbiting around stably. Again, you could fake one with a Lygite, and would appear exactly like our own moon if you liked. But that ring is quite bright at nighttime, too. All moon when full has a solid angle about 65 microstaradians, about the same as our sun has, and the Earth from the moon is about 14 times bigger, at 880 microstaradians, and would be about 14 times brighter in the sky on the moon than the moon is here, adjusted for different albedo or reflectivity. A Banks orbital is further away, so that a given moon or Earth-sized object would be reflecting on a 24th as much moonlight, or ring light, on its night side when getting sun, but that still means even a relatively thin ring of only a handful of Earth's living area is much brighter than our full moon, like some big bridge across the sky. Who needs constellations when you've got the ultimate nightlight? And very visible with its landmasses too. To the naked eye, with two layers of atmosphere on the way, it probably looks like a blue, green, and white smear, but even simple binoculars will let you identify bigger seas and landmasses readily enough, especially directly overhead where light passes through the least air both ways. You might be able to make out seas and continents with the naked eye, too. You don't see it curving away, either. The curvature is 100 times less than on Earth, and turns up rather than down, but should smear off into a red haze, then re-emerge as a red hazy ring, slowly turning blue and green as you look higher. When looking in the ring direction, which we'll call east and west, north and south are toward the rim walls, and by default we assume this is flat, other than landscaping changes, but I do think you would put a slope in to make the middle or equator slightly lower, which would result in a thin ocean belt around the whole ring, sort of like we discussed in Topopolis, the Eternal River, in our February Nebula exclusive. That structure is the exact opposite of the Banks orbital too, very skinny radius and incredibly long axial width, so it looks like a thread, not a ring. Don't think of the ring as being ruinously bright either. Folks tend to forget our eyeballs are logarithmic. The sun at noon is 400,000 times brighter than the full moon, so even a wider ring that might be 1,000 times brighter than the full moon is still darker than twilight or very overcast days. You do have options for handling that too, like having a nested ring inside made of panels that flipped out of the way for sunlight, turning perpendicular, but then rotated in to block ring light at night. I personally don't think you'd bother, given it wouldn't be as bright as many suburbs at nighttime, much less cities, but you might. Speaking of nested rings, in addition to the chain-link connection of the orbital, which I'll dub a Banks chain-link world, which could be through the middle or even close enough to touch atmospheres, which might be a neat effect, you could nest some smaller rings inside the orbital cocked at higher angles to give an appearance of an orrery of 3 or 4 of these together, maybe more. And of course you have countless additional facilities and smaller habitats in and around one too, adding themselves as constellations in the sky. Those cockeyed ones, which I will name a Banks orrery, could get away with being just, say, 10,000 kilometers smaller in radius for each one, with just 0.5% drop in gravity in order to maintain the same day length of that shorter radius. The rings would shadow each other a bit, but create far more connected living area, and direct physical connections would be possible using the same sorts of tricks we discuss in the Megastructural Compendium for devices like space towers or skyhooks. You'd rotate under each one once a day for an extra eclipse, so you wouldn't have more than a few unless you want to have your Banks orrery a bit closer to its star, but it would still be pretty minimal. You are spinning 300,000 miles per hour, so crossing under a higher ring, even 20,000 miles wide, is only eclipsing things for 4 minutes at a time. This episode should air about a month after the big annular eclipse a lot of North America is in, including my house. So for those experiencing it, you will recall that it's not really dark during an eclipse, just dimmer, more like a very thick cloud passed in front of the sun on a partially cloudy day. Amusingly, you could chain link these Banks orreries together too, a Banks chain orrery I suppose, and if you are chaining these, you could also do nested rings of them around that sun, just as we sometimes contemplate doing with ring worlds or run worlds to form a partial Dyson sphere. There are some fascinating variations of these structures over at Orion's Arm and some short stories and fiction set there. Orion's Arm is a shared open source hard sci-fi setting, and its Encyclopedia Galactica has always been a favorite resource of mine long before I started the channel, and many articles also cite me or were contributed to by me, so odds are if you like the show, you'll enjoy that site. The same goes for Ian M. Banks' Excellent Culture series, which is generally pretty upbeat and optimistic, and where the Banks orbital is just one of several giant megastructures we get to explore, and Banks was a great storyteller. The orbitals in there are their alternative to settling planets, as they just build those orbitals to live on as more mass-efficient and customizable. Now that we've explored them in theory and fiction, will we ever see them become a reality? Hard to say. I think if no other engineering barriers pop up, which is probably optimistic, we will at least see some built to prove it can be done, maybe even as soon as in a few millennia, but I'm a little less optimistic about them becoming the mainstay of civilization as they are in the cultural novels. In a few millennia, if we have not found something shinier to distract us, we might just build one, or we'll get halfway and decide to make a great tourist attraction as the galaxy's largest unfinished project. Either way, it's a win. Their size makes them a big investment and an interconnected one, whereas you can build O'Neill cylinders in smaller habitats, still able to house many thousands, Connect them by tethers and shuttles if you like, and still be able to pack one up and leave, since they are very easily modified to be spaceships. So I think it is easier for me to see a billion O'Neill cylinders being built and parked next to each other, connected by tethers, than a Banks Orbital, and both have similar total living area. Besides, we have bigger versions of these in the forms of the Bishop Rings and McKendry cylinders that can allow a potentially happy medium. That said, powerful people like to leave behind imposing monuments. You only need to look at the pyramids to understand how that works. So if you're an all-powerful, ostentatious ruler, or community wanting to leave your mark on history, you could do worse than creating a Banks Orbital legacy that a trillion people can live on with tons of elbow room. For more altruistic pursuits, we could produce continuous ecosystems bigger than a planet to house all those wonderful species that were snuffed out through natural calamities or human encroachment. So I think there's a future for Banks Orbitals, and a beautiful future at that. How could it be otherwise, in a solar system decorated with God's bracelets? To build and maintain an enormous construct like a Banks Orbital, you need patience and determination at a level almost inconceivable for a human, or even a whole civilization. For ultra-long-term projects like these, we may use machine minds. And this month's Nebula exclusive, Machine Monitors, will examine what sort of artificial intelligence we might select for such missions, and consider some of those missions, from building and maintaining megastructures to monitoring deep system defenses, exploring galaxies, or primitive worlds where life is emerging and may need monitored for millions of years. Machine Monitors is out now exclusively on Nebula, our streaming service. We can also see every regular episode of SFIA a few days early and ad-free, as well as our other bonus content, including extended editions of mini-episodes, and more Nebula exclusives like last month's episode Galactic Beacons, Crystal Aliens from Mulch, February's Topopolis, The Eternal River, January's Giant Space Monsters, December's episode The Fermi Paradox, Hermit Shoplifter Hypothesis, Ultra-Relativistic Spaceships, Dark Stars at the Beginning of Time, Life as an Asteroid Miner, Nomadic Miners on the Moon, Space Freighters, Retro-Causality, Orc OR and Free Will, and more. Nebula has tons of great content from an ever-growing community of creators. Using my link and discount, it's available now for just over $2.50 a month, less than the price of the drink or snack you might have been enjoying during the episode. When you sign up at my link, go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur, and use my code, IsaacArthur, you not only get access to all of the great stuff Nebula offers, like Machine Monitors, you'll also be directly supporting this show. Again, to see SFIA early, ad-free, and with all the exclusive bonus content, go to go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur. We were talking about mega-engineering only advanced civilizations could manage in today's episode, and we'll continue that look at advanced civilizations on Thursday, May 9th, as we look at the interdiction hypothesis of the Fermi Paradox, which asks if civilizations out in the galaxy might leave large buffer zones between their empires, and ask if Earth might be inside one such empty buffer zone. Then we'll continue the alien theme with a look at the reverse case of interdiction, where civilizations sprawl near each other and set up alien embassies. After that, it's on to the idea of massive galactic empires and the enormous cosmic capitals that might oversee them. As a heads up, in the last few weeks we launched YouTube memberships as another option folks can choose to help support our show. Memberships on YouTube come with some perks too, so if you're interested in learning more, just click the join button under any of our videos or the link in the episode description on any of our platforms, and you'll see the options and perks. I also wanted to thank everyone who has joined us last month, and everybody else who's been supporting this show for years. In a sea of clickbait and algorithm chasing, personal support really is what helps us and other shows keep producing quality episodes. And if you'd like to get alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to hit the like, subscribe, and notification buttons. You can also help support the show by becoming a member here on YouTube or Patreon, or check out other ways to help at IsaacArthur.net. As always, thanks for watching, and have a great week.